2 Peter 3:8 through 10. But do not overlook this one fact, beloved, that with the Lord, one day is as 1,000 years, and 1,000 years as one day. The Lord is not slow to fulfill his promise, as some count slowness, but is patient toward you, not wishing that any should perish, but that all should reach repentance. But the day of the Lord will come like a thief, and then the heavens will pass away with a roar, and the heavenly bodies will be burned up and dissolved, and the earth and the works that are done on it will be exposed. The word of the Lord.
Please pray with me. Lord, we do thank you for your word, and we pray now that you send your spirit among us to illuminate your word for us. Give us eyes to see how you are at work in us and through us. Help us to love what you love. We pray this in your risen Son's name. Amen. We're in this series called Undivided, and we talked about last week how, there are some places in the world where there are people who are, that they're not Christians, and they know that they're not Christians, and they're not mad about it. And then there are some places in the world where there are some people who are not Christians, and they know that they're not Christians. If you ask them, are you a Christian? They'll say, no, I'm not a Christian. And they're mad about it, some of them. We don't live in either one of those places. We live in a place where if you ask the average person, are you a Christian, here, they'll say, yeah, I'm a Christian. 9 out of 10 people in Central Arkansas, if you ask them, are you a Christian, they'll say, yeah, 9 out of 10. And one of the main realities that we are faced with as people who want to be serious students and followers of Jesus in this culture right now, in this time, one of the main realities is what I call just a fracturing of our life. And because so many people identify as believers, it creates a different kind of cultural context, and it's important that you are aware of it. And that context, there's a lot of different ways you can describe it, a lot of different ways you can nuance it. What I talked about last week is this idea that for many of us, as we experience what it means to be a disciple or follower or a student of Jesus, we have what I call a pie chart view of life. We have a little bit of time we're going to spend in work. We have a little bit of time we're going to spend with family. That's another piece of the pie. Another piece of the pie is whatever your hobby is. Another piece of the pie is your finances. Another piece of the however you divide up your pie. But the key idea with that kind of a pie chart view of life is the fragmentation. And the idea that one part seldom overlaps with or interacts with another part. And so, for example, that you can have a man who's a deacon at the church who cheats his business partner. And he considers it okay. Because that's just business. And so what we want to talk about this Advent. Advent is about, really, it's about waiting. Advent is about this double waiting, the Advent of the 4 Sundays that precede Christmas. Advent is about people, where we look back to how people are waiting for God to fulfill his promise to Adam and Eve in Genesis chapter 3, but especially to Abraham in Genesis 12, that he was going to send somebody. And so we look back to that long period of waiting, and it's also a time, and so there's all throughout that time, people were wondering, when is God going to fulfill the promise? When is that going to happen? So people are waiting for that, and we're also waiting for something else. Advent and Christmas is a time that points forward to a promise that God has yet to fulfill. And so it's very appropriate in this season here, when we're in this Advent season, and specifically when we're looking at it through this lens of being undivided, non-fragmented. Last week, we started talking about that, and this week we want to talk about that as it pertains to time. So many of us, I'm afraid, have a fragmented relationship to time. And Advent is all about time. The waiting for the first promise to be fulfilled, the waiting for the Messiah to come, and now the waiting for the other promises to be filled. You know, the Prince of Peace came. I remember we had an Advent calendar candles at our house, and we sort of, at our dinner table, we'd kind of light those and talk about them, and we talked about peace and so on, and explaining to my kids the kind of the double ask. People were waiting for the Prince of Peace, and finally the Prince of Peace comes, and I was explaining to my daughter a couple years ago, and isn't that great? The Prince of Peace comes, and everything's at peace, right? Yeah, that's right. And nobody fights anymore. Yeah, that's right. And you never fight with your brother anymore, right? So what gives? And it's because the idea that's gone all through the whole the scriptures is that whereas God's made this promise that he's going to return and he's going to set things right, that's partially here, but not fully. It's those promises, the gospel renewal kinds of promises, a different way of viewing time, a different way of viewing money. We looked at money last week. A different way of viewing the church. We'll look at that next week. A different way of viewing work. We'll look at that the following week. That there's a kingdom specific way of viewing those very mundane realities in our life. This is a school of life. Discipleship of Jesus is. And so what we want to look at today is the Luke passage. John has this. Mark has this passage. It's a amazing story. And so we want to spend a few minutes looking at what this passage has to teach us about how to have an unfragmented or an undivided approach to time. And so what we'll do is we'll look at three things. One, how we're being trained right now, how we're being trained to hurry. We're all being trained to hurry, all of us. Our culture, in a unique and unprecedented way, is training each of us to be hurried people. And so we're going to look at that. And then we're going to look at why that hinders our discipleship, and then how to get the power to change. So how we're all being trained to hurry, to be hurried people, why that hinders our discipleship, and then how to get the power to change. Just like a 30-second history lesson, you know. We live in a time, I remember when my dad brought home a computer. I remember it. You know, my kids probably won't remember a time before which they couldn't speak to computers and have them answer. That they're growing up in a world in which you can talk to a computer. The computer has a name. It's called Siri. And you can say, "Hey, Siri, how far is the moon?" And Siri will tell you how far the moon is. You know, when we're talking as a family in the car and we don't, what's the answer to that? I don't know. Sometimes my kids will go, "Ask Siri." We're living at a time where information comes at us in a very, very, very fast, faster than ever. And did Siri just answer? Siri may have just answered back there. I've been calling for Siri and she answers. Siri listens, you know. For most of human history, information only traveled as fast as the fastest animal. For most of human history, information only traveled as fast, and you can even add another point to that, not just as fast, but as far as an animal or a group of animals could travel. And so it put a natural limit on the kinds of information that was available to some people. You've experienced this. What's a major news story on Monday is forgotten on Thursday. Well, that seldom happened in the past, because that kind of people wouldn't go through the energy to get that stuff, you know, to make that news travel very far. So for most of human history, there was a built-in kind of a speed limit on information. And that changed when? What do you think? It changed when locomotive was invented. Now information could go at the speed of a train. And when that happened, clocks were already around. People already had clocks. But that was the time when now everybody kind of needed a clock, where it mattered whether the time in Chicago was the same time as in Little Rock. Because what needed to happen? The trains needed to run on time. And you needed to know when you could be there to catch your train. You didn't want to miss the train. And so whereas monks were the people who originally invented clocks so that they could better maintain their schedule of prayer, and nobody really needed a clock, there was a natural end to the day It was called night. When the sun went down and you didn't want to go through the rigmarole of having to do all the work to be able to even stay up, lighting things and so on. You just go to bed. And so, for example, the next time if you read a story about some great saint who woke up at 4 a.m. to pray, just realize that person went to bed probably at 6 p.m. That's 10 hours. You'd wake up after 10 hours, you'd be like, I'm feeling good, let's pray. It's a totally different world. There's a natural end to the week. It's called the weekend or the Sabbath. And so information started to speed up. And then it goes further. And now somebody said, I said earlier, what was the next fastest thing? Someone said the iPhone. That's the end of the story as we sit here today. But it certainly it's not the end of the total story, right? And so now when you, the younger you are, the faster your expectations are. If you text somebody, you expect a response back immediately. And if you don't get a response back immediately, maybe you'll call them. How'd you get my text? It creates the speed. We create our tools, and then our tools shape us. We shape the tools, and the tools shape us. That's a declarative, neutral kind of statement. It's just a fact. And so we've created some of these tools, and these tools, this is the important point, the tools are shaping our expectations of when things should happen. And how quickly things should arrive, how quickly things should be accomplished. And what we need to know is that the speed of those things is continuously accelerating at an exponential rate. So the speed, how is it that we're being trained to hurry? Well, one thing we need to recognize is that the speed of information itself is faster than anyone could have even contemplated. You know, when I was a kid, I would think about, it would just be great if we didn't have to, I don't like car trips. We'd get in the car, we'd drive, oh, it's terrible. Just transport me, you know, like teleport me. I would think that would be great, you know. I suspect there was a time where people thought, I don't remember thinking this, maybe you did. I suspect there was a time, wouldn't it be great if I could just communicate instantly with somebody else who's far, far away? Wouldn't that be great? Remember the whole stuff about the video phone? The video phone is coming. And now most of you have a video phone in your pocket, and it's no big deal. So information, the speed of information has rapidly, exponentially increased, and it changes our perspective, our expectations about how quickly things should happen. Here's another way in which we're being trained. Our attention, this is an important point, that there's a thing that people, that writers are calling the attention economy, the attention economy. Have you heard that term, the attention economy, or the attention merchants? Over the summer, I read this book with that title, The Attention Merchants, and it told a story that I think most Christians need to hear, especially today, especially where we are in the West. It told the story of the beginning of the idea that I will create a product that will capture your attention, and then I will sell your attention to someone else. And that way that I don't really know when that first happened, but he talks about, he starts the book by talking about penny papers in the early and mid-1800s in the United States. And the way that started was, if you were going to pay a newspaper to give you good stories, you would pay a subscription. That's how that was the business model. You pay money, they use that money to pay their people and run their business, and it's expensive. And so you have a high subscription cost. And typically, you'll get some good stuff back, you know, good, but maybe not. But that's the business model. Well, somebody came along, we would call them today a disruptor, came along and said, I've got a better idea. I'm going to sell my paper not by subscription. I'm going to sell it by paper, per copy. And I'm going to sell it at such a low rate that no one else will be able to compete. I'm going to sell it for a penny. And the way I will make money is because I'll lose money in the beginning, and I'll build up a reader base, and then I will go to advertisers and I'll say, 100,000 people read my newspaper, only 10,000 people read that newspaper. You should put your advertisements in my paper. And that was the beginning of people capturing your attention and selling it to someone else. And now we've seen this significant bloom in that, with various apps like Facebook and Twitter and all that kind of stuff. where you are the product. You are the product in those things. And I hope you don't hear any invective or hostility. It's just the reality. That's the truth. You're the product when it comes to those things. You're using a service, but what's happening is your attention is being captured. But it's way more nefarious than that. Everything I've set up to now is just descriptive. It's way more nefarious than that. Not only is your attention being captured, but people are creating those devices and they're creating those apps in a way to make you addicted to them. There's a business professor named Robert Alter who wrote this book called Irresistible. And in the book, he details his, I've been wondering whether he got sued for writing this book, because he talks about his relationships with different app companies and how he was a consultant, typically on a team of consultants, where these companies would, they would hire behavioral psychologists, addiction specialists, software programmers, and people like this guy, who's a kind of an ad guy. And the objective of the team was to figure out, how do we get you to look at the app? Because that's how we make money. Because we know if you clicked on our app, and we can tell advertisers, 100,000 people look at our app, only 10,000 people look at their app. And so if you're waiting in line somewhere, how do we get you to pull your phone out of your pocket and look at our app? We find ways to make you addicted to it so that you don't even think about it. This is sort of common. This is a kind of a what's the word to say? A not so well kept secret. Here's some other ways in which that works. In a print culture, which we're no longer in a print culture, there are natural what are called stopping cues to tell you it's time to do something else. An example of that would be the end of a chapter, or when you've finished reading the newspaper. Has anyone ever finished reading the news in here? Not anymore. People don't finish reading the news anymore. Because the electronic medium in the information age is created in such a way that there are no stopping cues, the infinite scroll. And so, for example, if you're a Netflix person, I'm often like laugh. I think it's funny, you know, I'll watch how quickly the Netflix show, as it ends, will get to the next one. It used to be, it was like, some of them, I don't know why they do it this way. I guess they're trying to push one versus the other. Sometimes they'll get a 15-second runway. Other times they'll give you a 3-second runway, and you'll see it, tick, 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 you know. Or if you're scrolling through, you want to see what you want to watch, you know, if you pause, don't pause very long, because it'll just start. There are no more stopping cues to tell you when you need to stop. And so what's happening is we're being trained to cram more and more and more and more stuff into our attention. Not just into our schedules and not just into our time, but into our attention. And so this is why more and more people are reporting feeling hurried and exhausted. Some people think that we will not be able to plant a church because people are too busy anymore. Their attention is too fragmented. They're too exhausted. And what I want you to know is that some of that is on purpose. Some people are deliberately trying to create systems that will hook you. Do you know that? And don't hear me say anything. I'm not saying anything negative about, I've got an iPhone in my pocket, which I just thought, ooh, I better put it on airplane mode before I start preaching. So I did, right before I came up to preach. Technology delivers wonderful things, many wonderful things. But like every form of technology, even back to the idea of writing something on a piece of papyri, it gives you something and it takes something away. Are you being thoughtful about that? And here what I'm trying to say is, the pace of information and the way that our relationship with technology as Christian people, the way our relationship with technology is working, it is training us to expect more, faster, now. It's training us to have a fragmented attention. There are so many people who, for example, wear multitasking as a badge. You know, if you, the idea that you can do multiple things at one time, you can do multiple tasks. That's why I don't like the phrase multitasking. You can walk on the phone, chew gum, and talk. If you think of those as multitasking, then you can multitask. But no one can multifocus. There was a family member that I had growing up where one of my main memories of relating to this person is I would say, "Would you please look at me when I'm talking?" And the person would say, "I don't need to look at you to hear." And I remember she was always doing something else. Many of us wear this multitasking. And so, for example, the average person, if you ask, "Hey, how are things going?" "Things are good, but I'm really busy. Just busy." I was reading a couple of weeks ago an article in the Harvard Business Review about how a study that was done in different cultures and how in American culture, busyness is viewed as a sign of status. If you're an important person, then you will be busy. And if you're not busy, it's probably because you're not sought after. It's probably because you're not wanted. Whereas other cultures, even other Western cultures, take the opposite view. So, for example, you'll see this in advertising. There was a time where advertising certain luxury goods, they showed a person sort of engaging in some kind of leisure. They were unhurried. And now, for example, if you see a Rolex commercial, it'll show a person running to catch a, you know, executive meeting or something. To show that person, if you wear this, you'll be a person of status. So we're being trained, and we're part of it. It's not just the bad guys out there training us, we're part of it. As we shape our tools, and our tools shape us. So we're being trained to be hurried people. We're being trained to be hurried people. Last point before we go, the last comment here before we go to our next point here, and we really dig into the Luke passage. We're being trained to be hurried people. What you spend your attention on shapes you. Do you believe that? What you spend your attention on, you become like that. The Bible calls that worship. The place where your mind goes when you're not really thinking about anything in particular, where is that? What occupies? We're not talking about really today, we're not really talking about busyness. And where we live in our culture at this time, everybody's going to have, busyness is an outward condition. It's something having to do with your schedule. And the odds are, especially if you have kids, you're going to have a lot to do. We're not talking about how full your calendar is, although that's part of it. What we're talking about is hurriedness, which is an inward condition. It's an inward state where we're always thinking about being somewhere else. We're always kind of breathless to get to something else. So what you spend your attention on shapes you, and we are being trained as a culture to hurry. We as people who are trying to be disciples of Jesus, because we're in the culture, we are also being trained to hurry. We're being trained to have that inward sense that we need to move on to the next thing. We need to add something else. Now, why does that hinder our discipleship? Why does that hinder our discipleship? Now let's dig here into the passage, Luke chapter 8. Luke chapter 8. Now when Jesus returned, the crowd welcomed him, verse 40, for they were all waiting for him, and there came a man named Jairus, who was a ruler of the synagogue, and falling at Jesus' feet, he implored him to come to his house. Why? The word implored. Basically, it's beg. Jairus comes and begs Jesus, please, come to my house. And the next verse explains why. For he had an only daughter who was about 12, and she was dying. Now, so if we freeze there for a second, Jesus is in this this ministry of teaching and healing, and we know from verse 40, that there's a ton of people around. It says, the crowd welcomed him. Yes, he's coming back. And all these people, we learn in a second, press in on him. You know, you can think about Jesus trying to make his way through the crowd. And here comes Jairus. And the disciples are with him. We know that because they are kind of incredulous a little bit later. In verse 45, and Jesus said, "Who was it that touched me?" And then when all denied it, Peter said, "Jesus, the crowds surround you and they're pressing in on you." Luke puts it kind of nicely there. Mark puts it a little more directly. And Mark says that all the disciples asked Jesus, "Are you kidding? You ask who touched you? There's a giant crowd all around you. Everybody's touching you." That's part of why I don't like being in crowds. Right? So all the disciples are there, and this guy named Jairus comes. Who is Jairus? The verse tells us there in verse 40, he was a ruler of the synagogue. That means he was a very important and wealthy person. He was a very prominent and influential and wealthy person. And he comes and says, "Please help me." A ruler of the synagogue. Remember this. There are some Pharisees that Jesus is railing against, and there are some people who do other stuff, like Jairus and like Nicodemus. It's a sermon for another day, but just note that here in the text. So Jairus comes, this wealthy, prominent, influential person comes, and the disciples are like, yes, because Jesus now agrees. Yeah, we're going to go help. And so, verse 42, and she was dying, and the text says, and Jesus went. It immediately goes. It said, Jesus says, yeah, we can do that. We can help. And so he goes, and the crowd comes and presses in all around him, and there was the woman, the text says, and you've heard it read. So the idea here is, that just kind of set the scene, the idea is that Jairus, this important person, has come. Hey, can you come to my house? You bet. Start the ambulance sirens, and we're moving through the crowd. We're going to go help. And the disciples are like, sweet, we're about to get in good with this guy, and that's really great. And then all of a sudden, he stops. Why does he stop? What I want you to notice is the comparison between Jairus and his cause and the woman and her cause. Look at the text there with me. In verse 43, and there was a woman who had a discharge of blood for 12 years. That means she was chronically ill. There's some kind of chronic illness that couldn't be healed. We know that from as the verse goes forward. And though she spent everything she had, that means she was poor. She had a chronic illness, which in that culture meant that you were being judged by God. People who were sick or had chronic illnesses is because they were being judged by God. You remember the story where the disciples see a man who was born blind? This is in John. I think it's in John 9, where the disciples see the guy walking, and the disciples ask Jesus, who sinned that this man was born blind? Him or his parents? And Jesus says, neither. Embedded in this culture is the idea that if there's something wrong with you physically, it's because you're being judged by God. And so here's a woman who's been sick for 12 years, which in that culture, and she probably believes it herself, that she's being judged by God. And she's poor. She says she spent all, the text says she spent all her living, all her money on physicians, and she could not be healed by anyone. And the text goes further. And then she came up, she touched his garment in this kind of weird, kind of superstitious sort of a way, you know? See, Jairus comes to her, comes to Jesus in public. Please, you know? But she kind of sneaks up in this weird sort of way and kind of touches his clothes, and this sort of thing happens, and she gets healed, and Jesus stops. In verse 47, and when the woman saw that she was not hidden, she had been found out, that she could hide no longer, she came trembling and falling down before him, declared in the presence of the people why she had touched him and how she had been immediately healed. Also, it was not a good thing. If you had a chronic illness, you didn't want to touch somebody else. But this is the thing about Jesus, how undivided he was. Every leper Jesus touches gets infected with his own health. The leprosy doesn't infect Jesus. His health infects and explodes away the leprosy. And the same thing here. So what you have here is a wealthy, prominent, very moral man, most likely. That was the idea. And he's a chief elder, one of the main elders, Mark tells us. He was a very religious man, a very wealthy man. And he's publicly begging Jesus to help the daughter. Not him, a child. And then on the other hand, you have a woman who's has a low status, who's poor. And not only that, she's a woman in a culture where men have most of the influence. And Jesus stops. And he asks the prominent religious man to wait. Now, there's not an emergency room physician in the world who would see to the medical needs of the woman before the child. Why? Because the woman's been sick for 12 years. She's not going to die, right? I'm looking at my doctor friends. She's not going to die. You're going to go to the girl because the text, she's dying now. And Jesus delays. Why does the hurry training that we are all regularly receiving and that we are a part of hinder our discipleship? Let me state it in a sentence and then expound it further. The hurry training that we're all receiving is problematic because Jesus, especially here in this passage, we see him saying, I fulfill my promises, but I will not be rushed. I will do what I say, but I will not be hurried. And many of us, either now, we're actively now angry with God because we feel like he has delayed to do something we have asked for. And that's good. Is there anything wrong with going to heal the dying daughter? Of course not. There's nothing wrong with the thing. And so many of us, because we're being trained to be hurried people, we don't have the kind of presence of mind and the clarity of conviction and principles that Jesus has here to be able to stop and sort of judge these kind of things. We don't have that. Not only that, but we expect Jesus to fulfill our agenda on our timetable. And if he doesn't, maybe we'll take our football and go home. Don't confuse faith and discipleship in Jesus with you assessing whether he meets your a timeline and agenda. Many of us have done that. I have done that. And there may be ways now that I'm doing that. Maybe ways now you're doing that. And so why it's so problematic for us to be in a time, in a culture where we're being trained to be hurried people is that Jesus will not be hurried. And that means the way he's ruling and reigning in our own lives is going to be according to his timetable and not always ours, or not ours, and those won't always overlap. So we go further here. This is the main point that I just stated, and I'm going to expound a little bit further here. So Jesus stops, and the text actually makes it seem like he talked to her for a long time. And you can imagine the disciples are going, come on. They're doing what we would do. This doesn't make sense. One point of application immediately there. Some of you are carrying anger and a little bit of distrust toward God because he's not answered a prayer that you have been praying and that you're currently praying, and he hasn't answered it in the way that you would hope for. Or maybe you're carrying around a kind of a wound because God didn't answer a prayer that you prayed, and the time for that answer is past. And you're not sure anymore whether God can be trusted. The logic that the disciples most likely employed here is the logic that we employ. It goes something like this. Because I can't see any good reason for God to not answer my prayer, fulfill his promise, therefore there can't be a good reason. What do you think about that logic? Because I can't see any good reason why God wouldn't answer the prayer in the way that I prayed it, therefore he can't have a good reason for that. What does that imply? there's a missing premise. It implies that I can see all reasons. It implies omniscience. It implies that I know all things. So Jesus is going to fulfill his promises, but he's not going to be hurried. He's not going to be rushed. And Jesus says to her in verse 48, and he said to her, "Daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace." And while he was still speaking, that's verse 49 there, while he was still speaking, someone from the ruler's house, somebody, one of Jairus' servants comes and says, would have to be terrible. I mean, put yourself in Jairus' shoes. Maybe you have been in Jairus' shoes. "Your daughter is dead. Do not trouble the teacher anymore. It's over." Jesus stopped to help someone who could have been helped later, according to our view of things. She had a chronic illness. Instead of going to help the girl who was an acute illness on the verge of death, and he knew it, and he had agreed to help, and he stopped. So you can imagine, you know, the chasm that would open up for Jairus in that moment. The hope. Imagine the roller coaster for Jairus. Let's say the girl gets sick on a Friday. Kids always get sick on Fridays. The girl gets sick on a Friday. And, you know, it's kind of hit or miss. And now it's Sunday afternoon, or maybe it's Monday morning or something like that. And things are going downhill. And Jairus knows some people because he's a prominent and connected person. He knows some doctor types, and they say, "We can't help her. This is it." And Jairus kind of prepares himself for that. And then he hears that Jesus is near. And he goes and finds him, and the hope wells up. And he's now, and Jesus, and he find, not only that, not only did he go find, he actually found him. And he actually made his way through the crowds, and he was actually able to speak with him. And not only that, Jesus agreed. Things are looking up. And then he stops. So there's a perspective from the disciples who are trying to gain a little social standing, like excited about the ambulance moving, and not unsure about why it stopped. But then there's perspective of Jairus, whose hope is now, has gone through a low, and now it's back up to a high, and then now it goes to a low again, and it's creeping ever lower as Jesus delays further. And then finally, it bottoms out when the servant comes and says, "It's over." And Jesus looks and says, "Don't fear, only believe, and she will be well." Don't fear, just believe, and she will be well. What I want you to see, before we go to our last point here about how to move from this discipleship of hurry that we're all being trained into, to the kind of poise and calm that you see with Jesus. What I want you to see here is just that. Notice the calmness. The times in my own life where I have said things that I have had to, you know, ask forgiveness for, or I have acted in ways that if we'd go back and do that over again, I would say this instead, or I'd do this instead. Most of those times, I have felt hurried. Me, I felt hurried. Last week, or 2 weeks ago, our family, my extended family, are like Disney fanatics. And every 2 years, we will meet them at some kind of Disney something. My nuclear family will meet them, and this year we did that. Don't go to Disney World during the week of Thanksgiving, because everyone else has that week off. And so 25% of America was in Disney World at that time. And we were booking it from one place to the next, one place to the next, one place. And then we was like, "Want to hurry up and wait," kind of thing. And we get, and that was a two-hour line, you know, so you wait in that line. And then you fight through the crowds, you know. And even as I was reading the text a second ago, now when Jesus returned, the crowd welcomed him. Just a few weeks ago, after we had returned, we got back from the trip. You know, have you ever been like, if you've been to the ocean or something, and you, or like a wave pool, and you kind of, you, your body moves in the waves, you know, kind of most of the day, and then you're back at the house later that night, you're sitting there at the dinner table, and your body is moving with the waves? Isn't that weird? I wonder if the guys who work the jackhammer, you know, if they feel like that when they go home, if they're still feel, surely they must. So we got back, and I asked Kristen something, and she said, well, let me look. And I immediately felt, she's not moving fast enough. We have to move faster. What is the problem here, you know? And I snapped. You know, I snapped at her. And I was like, what was that about? I said, I think I'm still back in the crowds. I've been discipled that quickly. I'm out of the crowds. There's no one pressing on me anymore. But I've been discipled that quickly into a things have to be done. We need to make a decision right now because we can't wait any further. We have to cross over here, go over there. Then we have to wait over there. We don't want to do that. We need to strategize to be able to get there fast. And most of us, many of us, live our whole lives like that. So when you go to the checkout line, do you scan all the lines and see which one is the shortest? And then you get in the one, you get it down to option A or B, you know, and you get in B and you're always watching, oh, that person came, that's where I would have been, and you're watching, you know. And if they get ahead, you're like, dang, fail. Do you do that? You may have a hurry problem. When you pull up to the stoplight, I do this. Do you count the cars? You figure out which one is the quickest one to get into? Well, there's a black belt version of that. And that is where you not only do you count the cars, what do you do when they're even? It's an even number of cars. Then you assess the speed of the cars and the type of cars. Do you do that? I do that. Maybe you have a hurry problem. Why? Discipleship cannot be hurried. Becoming more like Jesus, you can't microwave it. It's not a thing that can happen quickly. It's a thing that happens according to God's timeline, according to His good pleasure. So how do we get the power to move from the culture and the training of hurriedness, which many of us, I'd probably say most of us, experience? How do we get the power to move from that into a more Christ-like way of viewing time? Well, the first thing I'm going to give you two ideas here. The first is practice certain diagnostic tools. Now, these kind of, remember I said earlier that the tools, you shape the tools and they shape you. It's the same thing when it comes to this. Over the last, in preparation for this message, as I thought like about a month ago, so okay, we'll do, you know, we'll do the series Undivided. We'll for sure talk about time. And, you know, these are issues that I've thought about off and on over the years. And when I become conscious of the fact that I have defaulted into what I just described earlier, which is just a part of it, you know, calculating the stoplight, you know, the all that, I will make myself drive in the slow lane for a period of time. And it's horrible. And it just hurts. That's a tool. It doesn't make me more holy. It probably makes me worse in the moment, honestly. But what it does is it reveals to me that I have a hurry problem that can be masked when my hurry strategies succeed. And then I feel very good about myself. I wonder if you're like that as well. Come up with some tools, some practices. And here we are in Advent. There's probably no better time to engage in certain of these practices than now. Come up with some practices that you know is going to hurt you a little bit. Not because you want to be hurt, but because you want to have a gauge on how sick you are with hurry. It's always fun for me, if I can last long enough in the slow lane over a period of days or weeks, to notice how I don't mind being in the slow lane. It's just as slow as it ever was. The slowness never changed. I changed. And my need, this kind of craving, has been unplugged, at least for that time. Come up with some practices. And that, so my point is, you shape the practice. Maybe it's for you getting in the long line. Maybe it's for you, listen, aghast, turning off the phone when you come home. Or at least when you have dinner. That's a good stopping cue. We're going to turn off the phone for dinner. We're going to be unplugged. It's going to be off. They can wait. Come up with some practices so that what those practices do, I said they were diagnostic tools. They can show you how sick you are with hurry. And they can also show you how you're changing over time. So that's the first point, the first kind of idea. You need to come up with some kind of tools. You need to combat this sort of stuff because the reality is you're being trained in it now. Do you want to be trained in that? Do you want to be a person who is a hurried kind of person? Do you want to be known as somebody who's an anxious kind of person who, when you're talking to them, the person is looking beyond you to the next thing? Have you experienced that? You've been talking to someone and the person, you can tell the person's not there? We don't want that. None of us want that. But the reality is we are being trained to be like that. What are you doing? What practices are you engaged in to reverse that? For some reason in the church, there's become this weird idea that if you deliberately engage in certain practices, it's called legalism. It's only called legalism if you think that Jesus loves you more because you do it. Holiness is not opposed to effort. It is opposed to earning. Becoming more like Jesus, there are parts of our culture that are actually moving in the direction of the kingdom. It's not all bad. We want to get behind that and champion those things. And there are parts of our culture that are moving away from the kingdom. And we want to name that and not be angry and not be upset and not be fearful, but name it and say, there's a different way. Lord, help me to live that. The idea tends to be that where we are now, the way you become more like Jesus is you learn more. You need to have another Bible study. You need to have another sermon. You need to read another book. You know, remember Jesus says in the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew chapter 6, I want you to fast, I want you to pray, I want you to give to the poor. The part of what we have to recover is the idea that what you do with your body can impact your soul. What you do with your body can impact your soul. The idea that by fasting, it can bring you closer to the Lord, most of us don't believe that. We actually think that's bizarre. And that says more about us than it does about the practice, right? It's the same thing here. These are practices that you can engage in that are diagnostic tools, and to some degree, they're medicinal tools. They can kind of help. But really, here's the next point, and this is the last thing. Really, those are just kind of surface deals. They're just kind of surface things. I was reading it, you know, there's all these like meditation apps. You've heard about this. There's this, and they'll track your streaks. You know, like if you meditate today, it'll give you a little, really it's a dopamine hit. I mean, there are ways of getting you addicted to the app to meditate. You get a little streak, you get a little streak. And so people will then open up their app and do like they're going to do the meditation or whatever it is for that day, but not actually do it and just go fast forward through it so they can maintain the streak. See, the practices can be corrupted. It's not a reason to not engage in the practices. It's a reason to engage in them through a gospel-centered way, not in a way that this is all my own effort. And this is the last point, which is to see how this story with Jairus ends. Jesus does delay. The woman is healed. Jesus recognizes immediately that this woman needs something that he can provide now. And so he stops to do it. And then he goes to see about the little girl. And let's see what he says there. And when they came to the house, verse 51, he allowed no one to enter with him except Peter and John and James and the mother and father of the dead girl. And everybody was upset. Everybody was weeping and mourning for her. But Jesus looks around at everybody and he says, don't weep, because she's not dead, but she's sleeping. And they laughed, knowing that she was dead. Luke is a physician. He makes it clear. She is dead. But taking her by the hand, he called, "Child, arise." And her spirit returned, and she got up at once. This is one of those areas where it's sometimes good to compare the way that the different gospel writers treat a particular story. In Mark's gospel, his account of this, he gives the Aramaic words that Jesus says here in Luke, "Child, arise." Mark says, Jesus took the girl's hand and he said, "Talitha kum," which is Aramaic, which is the language that Jesus and the apostles spoke. It was their first language. Talitha kum, which is translated, little girl, this is how it's translated in Mark, "Little girl, I say to you, arise." And it's one of those many places where it's, I lament, I say, oh gosh, it's, you know, I want a literal Bible translation because I don't want the translators telling me what the Bible means. I'd just like to see it as directly as he can. But it's one of those places where I say, oh, that's that kind of Christian ease. You know, you can imagine Jesus saying, "Little girl, I say to thee, arise." You know, but the setting is the exact opposite of that. He doesn't allow anybody in. It's not a show. That's why Luke's very clear, and Mark's also very clear. Nobody is allowed in except the parents and the three closest disciples. So they come in, and Jesus doesn't say, "Stand back," you know? He's about to confront what is for us the greatest time bomb of all. Death. So much of the human experience is wrapped up in avoiding, postponing, dealing with, accepting death. And Jesus now confronts it in a 12-year-old deceased girl who he had promised to help. And Jesus reaches and he grabs her hand and he says, "Talitha kum," which does not mean, "Little girl, I say to you, arise." Talitha kum is an idiom in Aramaic. It would be like this. It's what I have said to my own daughter, who's now almost 11. "Honey, it's time to get up." That's why Jesus repeatedly said, "She's sleeping." The text is clear that she's dead. He's clear that she's dead. But death is like sleep for Jesus because of his power. And so he reaches down into death itself. He doesn't say, roll up his sleeves and say, "Stand back." He reaches down to death itself and says, "Honey, it's time to get up." Power. And a kind of a sensitivity. When you see that, do you think that Jesus lacks the power to address whatever it is that you've been asking for, imploring for, like Jairus? When you see that kind of sensitivity, that kind of power, that kind of presence, surely you can see, why would you want to hurry someone like that? Could it be because we're being trained to hurry? Could it be because we're being trained to expect instant results? The story about Jesus' delay. Jesus says, "I will fulfill my promises, but it will seldom be on your timetable. I will fulfill my promises. I will return. I will right every wrong. I will restore peace, but it will not be on your timetable." So the thing that you're praying for now, I encourage you to keep praying for, knowing that it doesn't all depend on you. The good Father is seeking you, and he knows what you need, and he has the power to give what you need. But I would encourage you to think about whether you can see all the reasons why God might be delaying. And so this week, as we continue in Advent and this season of waiting, and as we go to confession here in a moment, identify in your own mind, what is the thing? What is the thing that I want now, right now, that I want God to do right now? What is that thing? And ask for the grace to accept God's timing, to accept his schedule. May God give us all the grace to do that. Amen.